Hello, my name is Paul Kearney. I am a Professor of Politics and Public Policy at the University of Stirling. And this is Chapter 4, What Insights from Policy Process Research Do Policy Analysts Need to Know? Okay, now this podcast here is mostly introductory and scratching the surface. Now that's largely because I've recorded a whole bunch of other podcasts in other series. And on the website they're called 500 Words or 1,000 Words. The 1,000 words posts have a short podcast for every concept there. The 500 words page has longer lectures that I recorded for the MPP that I teach. So you'll find much more in-depth discussion of, what are what we'll call two foundational ideal types used to compare with the real world. Now, an ideal type in this sense is an artificial construct that we can use not as something that represents reality, but something to compare with it. Now, the first ideal type is this idea of comprehensive rationality, where policymakers have the ability to process all information, consider all possibilities, separate their facts from values, and perform policy in a kind of linear manner and such like. They're kind of all powerful beings. And we use that to compare with this idea of bounded rationality, which is that people only have the ability to process so much information and they have to come up with either cognitive shortcuts or organizational procedures to process enough information to make choices. The second ideal type is very closely related, and it relates to a policy cycle that is policy making through a series of linear stages. And that's probably one of the most popular models of policymaking, but also one of the most inaccurate, and we'll talk about that more later. Now, the sort of more accurate pictures of a complex policymaking environment, which is non-linear, and there's no all-powerful centre, pushing out policy from the top. So here we'll just focus on the key points, and you can follow up those in much more detail in other podcasts. Okay, so the first point that's relevant to policy analysis is incorporate policymaker psychology into policy analysis. So policy texts already do that to some extent when they talk about being concise and keeping it short, because that's about reducing cognitive load. That's a shortcut that you're giving to your audience. But the other is much more in terms of so-called cognitive biases or heuristics or emotions that people use to process information. And there's quite the literature now on what cognitive biases might look like or what they might suggest. So I've given you a list in the chapter, and it includes things like, audiences are vulnerable to the ways in which other people frame problems. They might see vivid events as more representative of reality than they are, and so they pay disproportionate attention to some issues because of their memory of those events. They might sum up entire social groups with reference to very few, and therefore characterize those populations in a really sort of simplistic way. They might value losses more than gains, which means they misjudge the trade-offs between what they have and what other policy choices there might be. They might have unrealistic hopes for things to which they've already committed, which can produce inertia or bias towards the status quo. They might have a need for coherence or to sort of make sense of patterns and assign too much certainty to very limited information. They might converge towards groupthink, which can limit the range of options that they consider, or their anxiety can cause them to make rushes to judgment, act quickly without full consideration. And, it's very difficult to sort of incorporate all of those things within analysis, but it's worth thinking about the ways in which people combine cognition and emotion to process information, and how we should think about how we should react. Now, in terms of policy theories, they're largely focusing on explaining what happens given these conditions. So some of those consequences include the following. So first, they have limited attention, so they can only pay attention to a tiny proportion of their responsibilities, and their attention tends to lurch from one issue to another. So you can see policymakers paying no attention to an issue for a very long time and suddenly pay attention to it. And, so you would incorporate that kind of thing into analysis, at least by thinking, well, there's no necessary expectation that someone's going to pay attention to this thing simply because I've written about it. Then there is a focus on power and ideas. So some ways of understanding and describing the world dominate policy debate. So they help some ideas and help marginalise others. They help some populations and marginalise other populations. Then there's a focus on beliefs and coalitions. So the so you might say policy actors see the world through their beliefs. They engage in politics to turn their beliefs into policy. They form coalitions where people share them, and they compete with coalitions who don't. We can talk about that later in terms of what an analyst can do about that. But what you might conclude just now is that the same piece of policy analysis might get great traction in one coalition, but be completely opposed by another. Then there's a focus on dealing efficiently with complexity, with strategies like trial and error rather than kind of central planning. Then there's a focus on how people frame issues and produce narratives to try and persuade them to take action. Then there's a literature on the social construction of target populations, in which policymakers draw on quick emotional or strategic judgments about people based on social stereotypes, and they use those stereotypes to propose benefits to some populations and punishments to others. Or there's a focus on rules and norms within policymaking. And, you know, the key point about institutions is that some of them are formal and written and people know what they are, but most are informal, unwritten. They exist in the mind of participants, so it's very difficult to find out what they are or how they're communicated. And then finally, there are studies of policy learning which suggest it's a political process in which people are engaging selectively with information to make political choices. It's not a rational search for truth. You know, so we bear these things in mind when we're thinking about how our audience would interact with the information we give them and how we should respond, you know, how we should anticipate these problems. Now, there are this kind of literature is not really designed to give you strategic advice, but there are, you know, these snippets of things that people talk about how to think about how successful actors deal with these kind of problems or constraints. So the classic kinds of advice is, you know, combine facts with emotional appeals to, you know, get attention from your audience. Don't expect the evidence to speak for itself. Tell stories that are easy to understand, and they build on people's biases, and apportion praise and blame to different characters and highlight the take-home message or the moral of a story. Or, you know, interpret evidence or frame your evidence to be consistent with the beliefs of the actors you're trying to influence. And, you know, be prepared to exploit a time or a window of opportunity when people have the opportunity to adopt a particular solution. Okay, so that really is all of that. It really just comes from a simple insight that you need to deal with bounded rationality, or deal with the need for people to combine cognition and emotion within a policy process over which they have limited knowledge and control. So the second point is to incorporate a sense of policy context and complexity into your analysis. And I would think of a policymaking environment as summed up as five or six concepts. So in the book, there's a picture of the policy cycle, and then next to it, there is essentially my attempt to do a kind of spirograph picture of lots of different cycles, which is a much more realistic kind of visualization. But, you know, it's not particularly simple or useful. So instead there's this other visualization, which is really just a collection of concepts. And you can tell a simple story about policymaking environments just by going through those concepts. So if you have this to hand, it's figurative, it's an image of the policy process. It looks a bit like a blue turtle upside down. And if we start at the top, you would say, okay, the policymaking environment is made up of actors, which is many different policymakers and influencers spread across many different policymaking venues. And venues are places where authoritative choice take place. Then you would say each of those venues has its own institutions. That's the formal rules that guide action, plus the informal norms and understandings that are difficult to pick up. In each venue, you can find different networks, which are the relationships between policymakers and the people who influence them. And within each venue, you tend to find different ideas or paradigms or dominant ways of thinking about issues. You know, so the classic would be, you know, in the treasury departments, there's a kind of idea about value for money, whereas in health, public health departments, there's an idea about, you know, evidence-based policymaking, that sort of thing. So the idea would be to sort of tap into what are these dominant ideas. And then there's this catch-all phrase, context and events, which is, you know, socio-economic conditions and things like elections or crises that can really tend to produce big lurches in attention. Okay, so if you look at the chapter, it gives you these summaries of narrative policy framework until the institutional analysis and development framework. Now, I'm not going to go through and summarize all those because, as I say, you can find those summaries in other parts of the website. Really, instead, what we'll focus on is what are the implications of these extra considerations? Now, the one big take-home message, this is the rub with policy theories. They're not particularly helpful if you're looking for practical advice. Okay, they really serve a different purpose, which is to prompt you to think critically about the environment in which you operate. So in that vein, you know, the big take-home message is that the context for policymaking is more important than the substance of your policy advice. And I think that's just worth thinking about, you know, about what could you possibly expect one document, its impact to be in a, you know, huge complex policymaking environment with a huge number of people. But what about more practical advice? Well, if you go back to that sort of turtle image, you can generate some general kind of bland advice about the benefits of long-term engagement. If you engage for the long term, you can learn where the action is, you know, which venues are most important. You can learn the so-called rules of the game in each venue. You can form alliances. You can learn the language that has the highest currency in each venue. And you can be in the right place at the right time to exploit crises and events. Or you could take sort of equally practical, but, you know, a more dispiriting advice from complexity theorists who would say, you know, things like law-like behavior is difficult to identify. So a policy that was successful in one context may not be successful in another, or the policy-making systems sort of defy central control. So don't be surprised when your proposed intervention doesn't have the desired effect, or focus on trial and error rather than a single strategy. Give local actors the freedom to adapt quickly, and so on. So in other words, a lot of complexity theorists suggest that analysts should avoid this idea of a single document, one-time policy analysis with a one-size-fits-all solution. Instead, the aim, or the quite unrealistic aim, is to encourage your audience to think of policy as continuous action, adapting through trial and error, and just to think critically all the time about what they're doing. Now, that's a big sell, isn't it? That's not so easy to encourage among an audience looking for a, you know, something more doable. Okay, but what these theories and concepts prompt us to do is think about the difference between what you need as an analyst, you know, your functional requirements, you know, so the steps you have to take and what you need policymakers to do, versus what this literature tells you to expect. Now, it's useful to think, what would you do if you start with this need to have practical advice, but you accept that this literature largely tells you about the limits to your likely impact and the limits to the policy action taken by a policymaker on the basis of your analysis? Now, that's not an easy thing to reflect on, but we'll go into that in more detail in chapter 7.